का मिलिट्री वेटरन कंप्यूटर मारू मैं वही डीजी फ्रॉम मिलिट्री वेटरन नो यू मस्ट नॉट थिंक ही अकाउंट्स टू पार्लियामेंट व्हाट इज दैट थिंग ऑफ हिम थिंकिंग We don't run this system. You can think when he's in head office. Yeah. We want him, because that is the most important program that is going to help members of parliament to understand. No. You take this thing of yours sometimes. You can really. Take it at about what time did you know you are going to talk?
1 hour 30.
People think that when I'm trying to explain that we all told at the last visit that there's this debate, they didn't understand. I wanted to start with the military veterans before the Air Force and the other division. Where is your?
I'm getting him.
Yeah, get him to come here. And then the last one will be military health support. Good morning, gentlemen from the Air Force. I know you are the Secretary of Defense. You will introduce to us the people that have come along with. And so we will start with the Air Force. We will take the military veterans, and then we'll finish up with the mini, with the health. Okay.
Thank you, Professor. I thought yesterday we had agreed that we know each other, that there was no need to introduce the people here. Oh, you don't know the Air Force?
No, we don't know who you
The Air Force is represented there by General Mbambo. Yes.
Where
is he? There, that's where. And then he is together with General Sima, sitting next to him there.
Chris got young generals now. That's very good, man. That's good progress. So, Master Mlambo, next to me, will stop complaining about transformation. Yeah. Welcome, gentlemen. These are honorable members of parliament from right there down. They are the ones that are going to listen to a presentation. The thing we are doing, we are dealing with the annual report and also. Out of the annual report, we wanted to get sectors, each one to be able to explain to us how things are going. We always appreciate you to be frank and honest with us. That's what Landward has been able to do, and that's what Maritime has been able to do. These are the people who will be able to give you a sense of how much support they will be able to give you in your efforts to improve and to find some money somewhere in the kitty to boost the defense itself. Now we depend on your honesty. If you hide, you're hiding yourself away from at least being getting some sympathy vote over some time. I know it's always difficult to convince many, but it's an effort that I know that all of us are working around the clock to get him to understand the combat readiness of the defense force itself. And through that, we could be able to work together. That means, man, I know you very well. How are you keeping?
Exceptionally well, thank you, sir.
Now I can see from your looks. Yes. So you'll give, who starts? Is it General Mbambo or you?
It's General Mbambo who will be leading, sir.
Okay, that's right. You give us everything that we know. You don't get irritated about members. They're not in the Air Force. They've never been there. I mean, Mazia grew up in Katong, so most of the time you see planes just flying over his head. He has never. So just give him that opportunity of him to appreciate. Oh, have you been an Air Force?
No, I've not been an Air Force.
Oh, where did you grow up? This chap doesn't even know where did he grow up, you know. I know him from Katong. But in essence, these are members of parliament who want to be taken through. You might think that some of their questions are irritating. Or they are very ignorant. It's not out of their own making, but it's out of their own responsibility where they would want to clarify themselves about the issues that are going to confront them when you are gone. So be patient with them. Don't get angry with them. That's what they want to do. Sometimes David irritates a lot of people, but we in the committee have really appreciated him because he adds value. with some of the things that he raised for us to be able to grapple with. So it's a challenge. So I do leave a lot of members to ask quite a number of questions on time. Dr. Mbambo, feel very comfortable to tell us. You can kickstart. And thank you very much. Now, I was just wanted to essentially say to members, yesterday that debate started. It was initiated by Parliament. And as you were going through the processes here, listening to Landward and others, it's only there that I became aware that there is a debate that is going to take place in the afternoon. At least I would have alerted members earlier, but I just knew about it as I was getting out of the committee meeting. Ratsoma was pushing me as I was walking that this is what they're doing. So it is a debate that caught us a little bit by surprise, but it's a debate. No, I don't want to open discussions about the debate, please. I'm just saying. I want members to feel comfortable. I mean, in the different strength of how we've responded to the issues, it was an initiative of the Speaker and the Executive and the Chief in Paris. Dr. Mbambo, let's take it from you. Thank you.
Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, thank you for the opportunity. Just before I start with the presentation, I would like just to make two comments. And it relates to our first visit that we had when we were with the Secretary for Defense. For me and also General Simang to be here and to give this overview, I must say that it's an awesome privilege because there are situations. I can make an example where you write a letter to somebody, but you don't know how he reacts when he receives the letter. Now, we have been part and parcel of making up the annual report from the point of view of the Air Force, and now we are in a position to walk all the way through and to be here and to give this overview. And for us, it's important because we can be in a position to see exactly how well have we written this letter. And this is the opportunity we are having, and we appreciate it. The second comment I want to make is the invitation that happened when we were here last time, where we were invited to sit in when the bill on Permanent Service Commission was actually tabled in Parliament. I must say it was a very good opportunity for us, actually, just to sit there and to listen how the whole process went and to appreciate that we, on that day, became part of history in terms of being there when that bill was presented. And it was also pleasing to understand that as this was done, we began to understand, actually, the responsibilities that goes around with that particular bill for us as a defense force. So on that note, I would like to say thank you very much for what happened previously. Having said that, I would like then to embark immediately on the presentation at hand. I will be covering the overview of the Air Force. We'll be focusing mainly on...
No, I wanted you to be clear. The technology of Parliament has improved. So why I'm not looking this way, I can look here.
Oh.
So don't be worried that I'm ignoring you. Technology is allowing me to look from here.
Okay.
Yeah, I can invite the Secretary of Defense to come and sit next to me so that she can also see the advancement of Parliament. Give her the opportunity to sit. So that me and you look from this side. Yeah, it's different from the defense. So I want to let you see technology is taking over slowly. So don't think that I'm not looking at you. We are watching from here, others are watching from there.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. My scope then will cover the following issues as listed there. It's introduction and the strategic objectives straight from the 09-10 annual report and why those strategic objectives were not achieved. And I'll talk about the achievements. And I will talk about the challenges and the mitigation of those challenges, and I will end up with a conclusion. First, on the strategic objectives for 09-10, the South African Air Force's main focus is to defend and protect South Africa and its airspace by providing 4 helicopter squadrons and 1 combat support squadron a year, providing 3 medium transport squadrons, 1 maritime and transport squadron, 1 light transport squadron, and 9 reserve squadrons at the required readiness levels a year, and also to provide 1 air combat squadron a year, and providing a 24-hour command and control capability. I would like to just highlight the issue surrounding the mandate and the allocation. We'd like to emphasize that the staff mandate and allocation is not aligned, which means then that the delta implies hard decisions that we need to take as a South African Air Force, and that has serious implications. Also, I'd like to bring to this meeting the fact that because the Air Force is unique, the underfunding problem is then become compounded by this particular fact. I will explain later in terms of this. Our total allocation for the year under review was the 3.1 billion, and it's broken up as follows. 1.6 billion was for personnel, and 1.5 was for operations. And in the year under review, the South African Air Force was underfunded by 132 million, specifically on operations. The strategic objectives that were not achieved. On the medium light and combat support helicopter, we had planned 11,920 hours, but we managed to deliver 10,431. The reasons were low availability of systems due to funding shortages, low experience level of ground crew resulted in services taking longer time to complete, and also production areas on Agusta 109 fleet that decreased availability. The ratio of Oryx commanders to core pilots was unbalanced with too few commanders. Here are the reasons that contributed in us not being able to fulfill what we had intended to fulfill in terms of flying hours. On the transport and maritime surveillance capability, we had planned 11,825 hours, but we only achieved 11,179. The reason: scheduled and unscheduled maintenance activities, technical failures, accidents, lightning strike, long lead times for spares that we order from overseas, and also financial constraints on some maintenance activities. Honorable Chair, I would like to bring the attention of the committee on the next bullet that says that the main contributory factor specifically around this capability is that we've got a very old air transport capability within the Air Force, and this contributes directly into the capability and it impacts on the serviceability of this particular aircraft. If I can just go quickly to the link slide there, which shows actually what is exactly the impact in terms of the aircraft age versus the stability of the aircraft.
Excuse me, it'll be your last slide.
Or the second last slide on your back. In your back.
Yes, in your hard copy. So here what we are explaining is that if the aircraft...
Be patient, Dr. Kong. Oh. What, remember, did you see that slide? Okay, that's right.
Okay, thanks. In this particular slide, what you are trying to explain is that the more the aircraft become old, it becomes actually very difficult to ensure that their serviceability is at a required level. If the aircraft are still new, you get a better serviceability because those aircraft are very new. Now, if you look at the slide, when the aircraft are still very new, when they are still new, the serviceability actually is quite high. But if you move with age of the aircraft, the serviceability actually goes down, as you can see with a green line there. Now, the The table at the bottom, it tells you what age of the aircraft and what type of the aircraft do we have, and they fall within what category of serviceability. From 0 to 14 years, we've got a Boeing 737, which is the presidential aircraft. At this stage, it's still a fairly new aircraft, and the serviceability thereof is much better. But if you move to the next category, 15 to 24 years, which in that category is the Falcon 900 and other aircraft that are listed there, the serviceability begins actually to slightly drop because of the age of the aircraft. And if you move to the last category where you've got the Falcon 50s and other aircraft, the C-47 TP, which is actually 66 years old, the serviceability there of those particular aircraft, if you can look at that slide, is actually even below 30%, which is actually unacceptable. So what we are explaining here is that the older aircraft are actually becoming even much more expensive to maintain, and the serviceability and availability is not guaranteed simply because of the age of the aircraft. The next one is the air combat capability. We had planned to fly 950 hours, but we only achieved 715 flying hours. The reasons: substantial underfunding of the system, long lead times on spares, Gripen support package has not been fully delivered during the under review, a major software upgrade was performed to ensure all aircraft are on the same modification baseline, and software upgrades on the Hawk affected the availability. And also the same aspect of long turnaround time for components in a repair loop. You will see that this particular factor cuts across all different systems, because the spares that we order come from our overseas for some of the systems. And the long lead times actually impacts on us having those particular spares at the right time, and therefore affects the availability and the maintenance of the system. I want to draw the committee to the last bullet on this slide, that the Hawk system getting out of warranty service contractual arrangement. This situation will now result in a situation where the Air Force will have to pay even more to maintain that particular system, because it's now getting out of warranty service. Our achievement: we have managed to fly 32,866 flying hours with only one major aircraft accident that took place during the year under review, which was the Augusta 109 that crashed. The Air Force continues to make maximum use of reserve force aircraft in lieu of chartering civilian aircraft, which is a much expensive option. During the year under review, we qualified 26 pilots. The breakdown is as follows: 11 for transport and maritime, 10 for helicopters, and 5 for combat capability. Moving on achievements, the Hawk squadron is fully operational for combat training. The main runway at Waterkloof is upgraded, and nearly all operations have been resumed. Commercialization of South African Air Force MESIS, resulting in savings for the South African Air Force. The first air traffic navigation system training has started within the Air Force, and this, we believe, will contribute towards the resolution of the ATC shortages, air traffic controllers shortages within the Air Force within the next 3 to 4 years. We have managed to do successful casual evacuation and certain rescue operations assisting other departments during the year under review. If I recall correctly, we managed to save about 59 lives in different situations during the year under review. Now, on challenges and the mitigation of those challenges. Scarce skills. We are busy interacting with the aviation industry and other relevant stakeholders to resolve this issue. But, Honorable Chairperson, I would like to draw the attention of the committee to the fact that scarce skills is both a national and a global challenge. It is not only the problem that is faced by the Air Force or by South Africa alone, it is a global challenge. Because pilots, technicians, air traffic controllers are a wanted commodity throughout the entire world. We are, in terms of the aviation technical training in the country, there are very few, if there are any, institutions that are actually focused on aviation technical training. Currently, it is the Air Force that is busy with this particular type of training. Now, being the Air Force that is leading or that is having a bulk influence in terms of aviation technical training, it goes without saying then that all other stakeholders are looking at what comes out of the Air Force so that they can be in a position to actually fill the gaps in their own environment. And that brings a challenge for us as a South African Air Force. We are currently busy with Denel Aviation to engage them in different activities to try and see how can we reduce the duplication of facilities and to reduce the cost within the our operations. We are also busy with the South African Airways where we discuss common challenges that we have, because if there are shortages in the country in terms of air traffic controllers, in terms of pilots and so on and so forth, South African Airways also has similar challenges that they face. So we discuss with them to try and come up with some mitigating situations there. We are also engaged with the air traffic and navigation system institutions to interact on common challenges that we face, because the issue of air traffic controllers is a problem for them and also is a problem for us. So we interact with them to ensure that we come up with some common solutions for common problems. On the combat system, Honorable Chair, we say that this capability will require intervention to prevent loss of the required capability. And the problem that has accumulated towards this situation is because of inadequate funding on the Hawk and the Gripen system since the onset of the integration of these systems. The Air Force has not been able to generate the required number of flying hours for these systems because we did not have enough operational funds to fly these particular systems. Now, the intervention in the short term that we have, we are looking at downloading the Hawk flying hours to the Pilatus, which is our trainer aircraft, mainly because we would like to ensure that the combat pilots continue to fly, even though they are flying at a different trainer aircraft, which has got the maneuvering capability of its own. That will help us in ensuring that at least they are not just flying desk, but they are actually flying the actual aircraft, even though a different aircraft. And also, we are making a decision to fly the Gripen at a very minimum hours, just to ensure that the system integrity and competencies are maintained. Because if we can drop from the minimum flying hours of the Gripen, we will lose the integrity of the system, and we won't be in a position to ensure that the pilot skills and competencies are maintained. So we have to fly it at a very minimum rate. We are also focusing on more utilization of simulators so that our pilots, at least, they can fly the simulator. But I must mention here, Honorable Chair, that these interventions are of a short term. We cannot maintain the system like that in the long term, because you can fly a simulator, but at some point in time, you have to fly the real machine, the real aircraft. It's the same like doctors. They can practice on certain things, but there is a time where they will have to really cut a live body and to see the blood flowing. This is the practical aspect of it. So we can use simulators for a short time, but at some point in time, we need to make sure that our pilots get on the real aircraft and fly. I would like to touch on the Air Force Base Durban issue. I would like to believe that all of of us are aware of the move that has taken place in terms of the establishment of the new King Shaka International Airport. Now, before the move to the King Shaka International Airport, we were utilizing the facilities at the old Durban International Airport as the Air Force and together also with AXA. With the new King Shaka International Airport being built, some of the facilities and some of the infrastructure is now actually not fully utilized. There is a whole lot of activities that are happening around the old Durban Airport facility in terms of its future utilization. We do not know exactly what will be the end decision of this, but it's got a very direct impact for us as a South African Air Force. In the short term, we are currently using the helicopter operations only at the Durban, at the Air Force Base Durban. The fifth wing air transport operations have been moved to be operated from the new King Shaka International Airport. The helicopter operations still remain at Durban, at the Air Force Base Durban. We require almost 27.2 million rand just to replace the temporary buildings at Air Force Base Durban in order to support or to sustain the current helicopter operations there. The buildings that are there at Air Force Base Durban actually have got an occupational health and safety implications. That's why we would like to ensure that they are revamped accordingly. In the long term, we would like to have a situation whereby the entire Air Force Base is actually relocated to the King Shaka International Airport, where we can have access to the facilities and to all the other infrastructure that is there. But to do that, it will come at a cost, because our estimate at this moment is that when we will move all the facilities to the King Shaka International Airport, it will cost at approximately 729 million rand from the South African Air Force. And at this stage, I can say that we do not have those funds. Now, what are we doing in terms of intervention? The South African Air Force continually raises its operational requirements through the Department of Defense, the National Department of Public Works, and other stakeholders, so that everybody must be aware of our needs and where we are actually running short. On the funding approach, it has happened in the past that we had funding has of the upgrade of certain systems have happened not from the capital but from the operating funds. And this has put the Air Force in a very bad situation, because our operating funds are not sufficient. But if a situation arises where we are forced to use the very limited operational fund to either upgrade certain systems, it makes our operational fund even much more inadequate. In terms of resolving the issue, we are thinking and engaging with the relevant stakeholders here that as we move forward, if we are going to maintain and upgrade our systems into the future, the money that should cater for that, it should come from the capital fund and not from the operational fund, because it will seriously deplete our resources. So there is a thinking around that direction, so that we can make sure that our operational fund remains secured. I'd like to touch on the impact of low funding, Honorable Chair. Low flying rate has got diverse implications for the South African Air Force. If you don't have enough funds, you fly less, and there are a lot of implications associated with that. Support to operations is affected. Force preparation is affected, including other relevant services. Retention and representativity improvement is also affected. This is because if you fly less, air traffic controllers are not going to have enough time to control. Technicians are not going to have enough time to get hands-on in fixing the aircraft that are not flying. There's a whole range of implications that are associated with a low rate of flying. And it also impacts on the on the safety of the aircraft themselves. And also, there is an appropriate balance between different capabilities. The Air Force runs, it's got helicopter capability, transport and maritime capability, combat fighters capabilities. Now, if there is a low funding, it means the entire capabilities are not balanced. It's either you will have transport faring well, but the helicopter will not fare well. The combat system will not fare well. So there is a whole range of imbalanced capabilities that we have because of low funding. The intervention that we are currently doing, we are focusing on using more simulators to ensure that our pilots continue to at least have that competency. But as I said earlier on, simulators we can use, but it's something that cannot be relied on permanently on a long term. We are also engaged, like I have said earlier, on different discussions with the South African Airways and other local airlines to try and address some of the problems that we are facing. Here I'm talking about sharing air crews. I'm talking about the core utilization of flight attendants, because some of them they can be used within the VVIP squadrons, and also the training of these particular individuals. We are sharing courses and so on and so forth. Like I have said in the earlier slide, we have started to train ATNS within the South African Air Force, which trains the air traffic controllers, and we believe through this interaction there's going to be some returns as we move forward. I'd like to touch on, Honorable Chair, on the command and control capabilities. Here we are talking about the radar systems and all associated mobile equipment, which are very old. We are talking about the South African Air Force communications network and infrastructure. We are talking about mobile air operations team support capabilities that are not guaranteed at this present moment. You can have the fighters in the air, you can have air transport and helicopters in the air, but you will not be in a position to deliver if you don't have effective command and control capabilities, if you don't have radar systems that are at the right level, if you don't have communications network infrastructure that is up and working. You are not going to be in a position to deliver air power as required. So these systems are very old, and they've got a direct impact in terms of our capability as the Air Force. What is our intervention? If you look into the Strategic Capital Acquisition Master Plan, which is a capital acquisition plan that informs you what are the projects that are supposed to be phased in and at what time. In that particular program, the Air Force has put command and control capabilities as the first priority to address the whole issue of the radar systems that needs to be acquired. In conclusion, Honorable Chair, we are saying the South African Air Force has a unique mandate, and that is the air defense of the Republic. And this particular mandate cannot be entrusted to any other service or division. It is a responsibility solely of the South African Air Force. The South African Air Force, Honorable Chair, has valuable assets in the strategic defense packages with a proven track record so far. If one reflects on the Confederation's Cup preparations, if one reflects on the recent FIFA Soccer World Cup that took place in this country, surely there are definite and tangible results that we can show that these assets are a value for this for our country. But again, we are saying any system integrity loss for our strategic defense packages will result in a more serious problem, and it will become even more expensive to recover them. And lastly, Honorable Chair, we are saying we believe that there should be a fair balance between the mandate and the allocation for our capabilities, and this needs to be found. On that note, Honorable Chair, I'll conclude. Thank you.
Any additions from your side, Dr. Usman? You're a happy man. The general represented your vision. Honorable Krundabas?
Thank you. You're asking whether I'm happy or not.
No, no. I know at least you have a sense of combat readiness.
The problem is if there's not readiness to a person, then you cannot have the sense. You were asking me to ask questions.
Yes, that's
okay. Right, thank you, Chair. Chair, I want to ask a couple of questions.
Right.
Firstly, on the pilots, you stated there that you've got 26 pilots qualified for wings. Now, my question is, 26 qualified, of the 26, 5 combat pilots have been qualified. But what do we need? How many pilots do we need? And how many do we have at the moment? Thirdly, how many of our, and I'm speaking specifically as far as our combat pilots are concerned, and I include the helicopter pilots, how many have left the Air Force for the last 3 years? I'd like to know that, because it also, it's part of the scarce skills, one of your challenges. And you say that in your slide 10, the scarce skills is both a national and global challenge. How many technicians has left? Because at one stage I knew that Australia was a very favorable destination for our pilots. And then I also don't understand quite clearly, on your slide 9, you say the Hawk Squadron is fully operational for combat training. So it's fully operational. But in your slide 11, you say due to inadequate funding of the Hawk and the Gripen system since the onset of integration, it's not been able to generate the required number of flying hours. So how can it be fully operational for combat training if you can't fly the required hours? Also on your slide 11, how many Gripens do we have at the moment who fly? How many has been delivered and how many is flying? And last question, Chairperson, on slide 13, you say in the past some upgrades have been partially funded from the operating budget. Now this is very serious when you have to use your operational budget to ensure that you obtain other aspects. Now what amount are we talking about here? How much of your operating budget did you take away to use, and I know, you've used it maybe for salaries or maintenance or whatever. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Mpashele.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Thanks so much, General, for your great presentation. I must thank you, Honorable Chair, for warning the General that some of the questions you are going to ask are actually foolish. But I'm told that the foolish question is the one that wasn't asked. On slide 3, you are talking about helicopter squadrons, transport squadrons, combat squadron. Can the general give this committee an idea of what is a squadron? How many helicopters make a squadron? So that we can have a vague idea of what we are talking about. Somebody may think that the squadron is 1,000 helicopters and another one thinks that it's 2 helicopters. Slide 6. You are here mourning about the 8 aircraft. What must be done about them, the 8 aircraft? What can be reasonably done about them? Should we destroy them and know that we no longer have any aircraft? Should we sell them or should we simply decommission them? Because if you say it's costly to service them, then why should you keep them? have an idea of a Skorokoro car that is actually more expensive to maintain than to get rid of, and know that you no longer have a car and start boarding a taxi. Slide 7. Grip and support package has not been fully delivered. Reasons for that? Who is to take the blame? Slide 8. 26 pilots qualified for wings. Through you, Honorable Chair, I think the department, when they cite their achievements in future, should give us a demographic and gender breakdown, because we always ask this question because it is at the heart of transformation. So if you give us raw numbers like this, we go out, you know, not knowing whether this army or this air force is being transformed or not. So I think a demographic and gender breakdown will be helpful. On more utilization of simulators, what is less expensive? Because I think simulators serve, you know, the same purpose, except that no one can be relied on if they have been trained on simulators and simulators only. So, but if we can have more time on simulators and less on actually flying out, you know, against the elements, the storm, etc. So, which is a costlier option. Lastly, on the question of challenges and mitigations, you are saying here discussions and agreements with SAA and other local airlines. Which are other local airlines? May you name them, General, so that we should know them. Thank you.
It's one time.
Oh.
I got you. I don't even know myself. Stop pulling your leg. Okay. Can I have Honorable David Maynard? I saw you today. We've got a roller. What's going on with you there?
Thank you, Chair. Let me begin by saying, or by thanking the General for his presentation. It's very hard to infer anything else from the presentation other than the fact that the Air Force is in a very deep crisis, and that our pilots seem to be on track to be flying desks and flying simulators rather than flying aircraft. And I think that it's something we have to take very seriously as a committee. General, I'd like to ask four categories of questions, touching on the air combat capability, on the VIP squadron, on the helicopter capability, and then on the acquisition project. Can I begin with the air combat capability? Let me begin with the Gripen system. Would you tell us the number of Gripens which have been delivered, and the number of Gripens that are operational? In respect of Gripen pilots, would you tell us the total number of operational Gripen pilots? And by that I mean the number which excludes Gripen instructors, reserve force pilots, and test pilots. I want to know the number of fully qualified operational Gripen pilots. Then, more seriously, you've told us, General, that the Gripen system at current funding levels cannot be implemented fully. Now, my question, is there a plan to rectify that? And if there is, what is that plan? Because my concern, if you look at the adjusted budgets which we will deal with this afternoon, that we are taking money out of the air combat capability, not putting money in. I mean, we are going to vote this afternoon on the budget, and we are in fact taking 971 million rand out of the air combat capability, knowing full well that even at existing funding levels, the system cannot be fully implemented. Can I then move on to the Hawks again? Could you tell us the number of Hawks delivered and the number of Hawks that are fully operational? And again, in respect of Hawk pilots, the number of fully operational Hawk pilots, excluding again instructors, reserve force, and test pilots. On slide 11, I wonder if you could fully explain what you mean by downloading Hawk hours to Pilatus hours. It seems to me that the very reason that we purchased Hawk aircraft was as a trainer system so that pilots could train up and then move on to the Gripen system. It seems now that that approach is changing and our jet pilots are going to be trained on Pilatus aircraft, which then raises the question of why we have the Hawks at all. I wonder if you could just fully explain that. I don't want there to be any misunderstanding or misconception. Can I then move on to the VIP squadron? In the annual report, it's made clear that the VIP squadron is insufficient for the demand, and because of aging aircraft. Now, the solution you referred to on slide 8 is to utilize reserve force aircraft in lieu of chartering. I wonder if you can explain exactly what that means and how the system functions. Then again, on during the previous financial year, there were two incidents, and of course our committee must be concerned with the safety of VIPs, particularly the safety of the President and the Deputy President. There was an incident, as you know, in the DRC. My question is, was there a board of inquiry? What were the findings, and was any action taken? Similarly, there was an incident in India with excess baggage. Was there a board of inquiry? What were the findings, and was any action taken? Finally, on the VIP aircraft, given your presentation, is there a project to acquire new aircraft for the VIP squadron? Chair, I won't be long. I'd like to then move on to the helicopter capability. General, you'll be aware that there were several articles in the press this year about the Royfox system and the fact that the Royfox were mothballed and in storage somewhere outside Bloemfontein. I wonder if you could clarify exactly what the Air Force plan is with the Royfox system. Finally, Chair, on acquisition, we all know that the Airbus A400M project was terminated. I wonder if the General could give us an update about whether there is a plan to acquire transport aircraft for the South African Air Force. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I just also want to ask some few questions, but it seems the problems in the defense force are all funding. The person on slide number 4, the general of the set is going to explain to us the uniqueness compounds the problem. I didn't hear what you were saying, what was it? Uniqueness of the problem. But the other question I just want to ask, from experience, what is the, whether is it advisable to service those aircraft that you say the services or the serviceability is already low? Why should you service it if you see the service capability is low? Is it any
usage that you get from it.
The other one, the crash, we didn't hear much about the crash. What was the cause of the crash from the investigation, if there was a real investigation from that crash, so that we can know what was the cause? Is it this whole age story, or was it a mistake from somebody? I would like to hear from there. And then the other, you know, this simulators. I'm not sure, I've been working with simulators from where I come from. Are they reliable? Can somebody rely on them as something that you can train a person and say, yes, this person has been trained and we can trust them from a simulator? Thank you.
But you can't use simulators and farms. Oh, I'm suspicious. I didn't mean that they're coming far. That's not.
Well, well, thanks, Mr. Chairman, and I also would like to greet the General there. And my question is only one, Mr. Chairman. It actually relates to information regarding the training of pilots, which is on slide 8. And I also see that only 26 pilots were trained. Mine is actually on the cost. How much would it cost the effort to train just one pilot? And also the issue of turnover. How many are we losing after training them to the private sector? And if so, I mean, what kind of strategies do you have to retain our pilots within the Air Force? Thank you.
No other members got a question?
That's good.
Oh, Tatu Tola. Left to the Zambezi.
Jefferson, you disturbed me. Thanks very much, Jefferson. Jefferson, I just want to ask, 32,866 flight hours were achieved with one major accident. Honorable Masango was asking this question, but I just find out, on that accident, there is somebody who died or what? If somebody died, how many of them? And, you know, Jefferson, slide 6, they're talking about very old age sector in some of the aircraft. I've got a Mercedes-Benz, I bought a Mercedes-Benz 1994. No. At the time when my mom born in 1914, and she's still alive. And it's now 16 years of age. Now this aircraft, that old, 10 years, 5 years, 15 years, and so on and so on. And another thing, Jefferson, I just want a comment, Jefferson. You know, we must work very hard as a committee, and as a South African, all of us, to make sure our defense force to be as strong and strong and strong. And why I'm saying this, Jefferson, these days, the army, they must try to help the police fighting against those people who killed the rhino. And the soldiers, they must now do the work. And when the gentleman is talking about sometimes we've got a problem about we don't have enough money, which means the army, that's very important. You know, in our, no, I'm not sure some other culture, but I'm a Peri, in a Peri culture, but I know all of us, especially African people, so-called Africans, before you're going to build them cook, in rural area, you are looking African top to try to secure your home. Another man who is loving, you know about that. Now, which means, I'm trying to say, to make sure to build a strong army, which means you are going to sleep well in your house, in your home. And I think when we come to the budget, Jefferson, I know the time's come. We must make sure, start now, must get more and more budget the department, then you can solve all those problems we have. Lastly, you know, when we make a site visit in Bedbridge and KwaZulu-Natal somewhere, then Komatipoort, we used an helicopter. You know, I don't know, but I was looking. It's an old helicopter. There's no toilet inside there. You know, I was asking pilot if maybe my stomach running. How I'm going to do? I'm telling you, it's terrible. People like us, we've got high blood pressure, and there's no aircon. Then you can see if somebody is there, is a pilot, whatever. Those kinds of things are not there. It's terrible. But I think we must work very hard, Chairperson, to give army support, and we must make sure for this coming budget vote, we must make sure our department to get that's right. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Honorable Tolu. You were the last one to ask questions on this round. You answer all the questions. I do know General Mbambo. You do know that there is a head here that leads the delegation. So she'll direct how you answer your question. And then after that, we would take the military veterans. Thank you for coming, DJ. We wanted to start with you, but we are quite fairly aware of you getting lost in Parliament, but welcome to be here. Don't worry. I'm suspicious in China that you got lost. We'll take you after this particular presentation. You'll be the next one. And then if it's military health. Okay. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Can you go ahead?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think General continue to answer the questions that have been asked. Just to say that, you know, the question on the VAT is one of the questions that was asked in the list of questions that we received from the committee after our initial presentation. So it is answered there. I think some, and also some of the questions that were asked also appear in those answers. But General Mbambo will then continue. And then on the issue of the numbers, the pilots, because we asked about the number of pilots, if you're not sure or if you don't have them with you, it's no problem. Dr. Lidwaba has got them there. He will assist you. And anything that has to do with the funding, if you're not sure about it, Mr. Engelbrecht will assist you. I think you can continue.
Just allow them to answer all these other questions, so that maybe members are just making sure that they recall what were the answers for record purposes. No, David, don't ask your man from the door. Don't harass the door. David, don't start. The door, don't give your man that I don't do off. You see, because you two, when you start fighting, I must now intervene. You see. Can you kick off, General Mbambo?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I will answer the questions not in any particular order because I was taking notes here while the members were asking questions. And those questions that I won't be in a position actually to give a comprehensive answer on, I will highlight those and come back to the committee about the comprehensive answer on those particular questions.
As you know, the rule is very simple. Where there's national security involved, you know more better than us. You don't go into that particular detail, but you don't want to be involved in that. So if you break it, don't come and complain to the portfolio committee. Take responsibility. We have guided you, we have told you, know you were part of the plan when we said we are dealing with annual reports most of the time. When national security is involved, don't get involved into it.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Let me start with the issue that was raised in terms of the downloading of the hawk hours to the Pilatus. Just to explain the concept. With the situation that we are faced with in terms of underfunding, we had to make some intervention, because if we don't, the situation gets worse every day. Now, downloading of hours of HOC to the Pilatus simply means, and as I have indicated in my slide, it's the area that we are investigating so that we can see how can it be implemented, is to say that you take the pilots that are on the HOC, you move them down to the trainer aircraft, the Pilatus aircraft, and actually you create a squadron there that will continue to fly. What are you achieving by doing that? One, the Pilatus aircraft is actually a cheaper aircraft to fly as opposed to the Hawk. Secondly, you are avoiding a problem whereby you don't have much funding to fly the Hawk, and you result in a situation whereby there are pilots that are sitting and doing nothing. Now, if you are introducing that particular approach, you are going to have a situation whereby these pilots are flying. Of course, they are not flying a Hawk, but they are flying a trainer, which is a Pilatus. It's got the maneuvering capability. It's got some of the capabilities that you can find in a combat fighter aircraft. So, in so doing, you are trying to alleviate a problem, as opposed to just simply throw up hands and say, look, I don't have enough funding here, and pilots are going to continue to be in the Hawk system and not accumulate any hours and just accumulate them. I would like also to just indicate that we must remember that the Hawk system is a feeder to the Gripen system. How the pilots move up in this combat capability. You train them in the Hawk and they accumulate and then they move into the Gripen system. Now, if you don't have actually enough funding and the Gripen system is still being integrated, now there is a load of pilots that are on the Hawk system. You're going to clog the system if you don't do anything. So that is why then you have to come with some kind of an initiative to make sure that there is a way of addressing the problem. So, in short, the downloading of Hawk hours to the Pilatus is exactly mean what I've just tried to explain here. I would like to move on then to the next question.
I would like to add on to what Jerome Bamba just indicated. With the downloading, when you look at the pupil pilots that have been streamed for the fighter line from Langeberg, instead of them going straight into the Hawk squadron for training for the fighter line, we then keep them on the Pilatus for a longer period to gain hours and so forth. They would then be trained by a Hawk, fighter instructor who is qualified for who's qualified, and they will then be introduced to the maneuvers, basic maneuvers that can be done on the Pilatus. This will help us also to ensure that the transition from the Pilatus in terms of hours and experience and so forth, is much more smoother. Though they will be spending more time on the Pilatus, but they will also be gaining
the handling qualities of the Pilatus is almost similar to that of the Hawk. So it is not that much of a train smash. It's just that when it comes to the question of the now the weapons delivery and so forth, that is another thing. But when it comes to the question of them getting the hours and the experience, I think it will also benefit the pilots.
Yeah. Well, I think that what's also important to remember that the aviation, the electronics, the instruments of the Pilatus and the Hawk are very similar to one another. So that makes the transition from the Pilatus to the Hawk also much easier. The Pilatus aircraft underwent a upgrade in the avionics, which specifically to improve or to make the transition from the one type of aircraft to the next type of aircraft much simpler. So whether you fly on the one or the other one, the cockpit layout looks very similar. And therefore it's much easier to go over from one to another aircraft.
Yes, this has been also captured in the training needs analysis, which looks at the training of the combat pilot. So them going through the Pilatus is part of our philosophy. So it is not something that was just thought up. It is part of our philosophy.
Yes, I would like to then address the issue which was asked with regards to the, it appeared on my slide, where I spoke about the chartering vis-a-vis the reserve flying, the reserve force utilization. What we have done within the Air Force, as far as possible, we utilized the reserve force squadrons, which are part and parcel of the Air Force formations, to utilize them for flying the VIPs where they can and where it is possible. So that is why we continued to do that, and it worked cheaper if you compare it with the chartering. But I must also emphasize here that we can only do that as far as possible and as far as the capability of the Reserve Force Squadron allows us to do that. In situations where it's not possible to do that, then we don't have any other option other than actually to go through the charter route. Again, I would like to just, the other issues that were raised in terms of the Board of Inquiry and things like that, the answers we provided them formally, and I think they were handed over in terms of the Board of Inquiry for the President and the situation of the excess luggage, that was answered in writing. With regards to the purchase of any new systems in the VVIP environment, I can only say that within our new air transport strategy, we are indicating that there is a need to augment the current capability within the VIP categories. But at this stage, there are no specific plans for the purchase of new aircraft for this particular purpose. Our strategy simply indicates here is the delta, and here we need to augment by certain type of capabilities. That is captured in our transport strategy. Honorable Chair, I would like to address then the question that was raised on the air combat capabilities, both the Hawks and the Gripen. I would request through you, Honorable Chair, to get there was a specific issue that was asked regarding the current qualified pilots as we speak today and in both systems. I would like to get some advice on that one, because it touches exactly on the issue that you have talked about in terms of the security of the country in terms of what we have currently for combat readiness.
That can't be a threat. I've asked this question in Parliament a couple of times. What is the threat? To know how many combat pilots do we have? Could let us know. Thank you.
That's what he's saying. That it threatens the security. That's what it is. General, it's international security problem.
It's taking into the actual capability that we have as a CTN. And another thing that I must say, Honorable Chair, the combat readiness of pilots will differ from time to time. I can give you an answer now that this is what it is, but as I walk out of this room, that answer is not perfect anymore. So this is why I say if there is a very strong feeling that I need to give a definite answer on this one, can I come back on it then, if this is the feeling of the House, Honorable Chair?
Give
this one
to
can I give another member?
Okay. Chair, I mean, we've discussed the issue of transparency before, and I certainly associate myself with the Honorable Peter Groenewald's view that there would be no threat to national security if we discuss this issue. But I think that the general does need some protection. It should not be his decision about whether the information ought to be revealed or not. I don't believe that is the kind of water that a serving officer should have to carry. I think that the decision should be taken by the minister. And if we have a disagreement, which we're bound to have, then we will slog it out with the minister, not with the general.
Don't get into it, General Suman. I think I must stick to the advice given by Honorable Maini that you can keep. I accept what you're saying, Honorable Kunawan. I don't dispute it, but I think when it's in Parliament, you're really directing it to the minister that gives that type of response. What we are saying that the official himself at a particular moment would have to bow to the minister. But it's not him who can. He if it was according to him, he wouldn't be saying that he can't answer the question. But the difficulty is that he has to consult with the minister on a particular area. That's what he own understanding is that he does have a national threat.
Chairperson, I've got a problem. The Portfolio Committee is an extension of Parliament. And if the SANDF is sending someone here to represent, in this case specifically the Air Force, that person must supply the answers to the questions asked here. If the minister has to take the decision, then the minister must ensure that she is present to answer to the questions. Or else we cannot do our work. And with great respect, I don't understand. The general with great respect says, the answer he's giving us now, if he walks out, then it will be different. So then I can't understand what is the national security. Give us the answer now, so when he walks out, it will be different, and nobody will know it, then it will not threaten state security, because it has changed. I don't know, maybe one got disqualified or something, so nobody will know the exact answer. So can we give the answer now, that we can know what it is now? Then next year I will pose the next question, because there's no time, and then we can get the real answer from the minister. Thank you.
I sympathize with Honorable Kornaga. I'm just imagining how he feels to want a question answered and it cannot be answered because of the reasons that have been tabled. Honorable Kornaval, through you, Chairperson, you see, it's not only members of Parliament here. It's members of Parliament, it's the press, and it's other people that you don't know whether it's safe for you to say anything that you want to say. So possibly if it was a closed meeting, we would not be having this situation. We would be insisting that we get answers because we have a right to those answers. So I want to plead with Honorable Quarterman through you, Chairperson, that possibly we make progress on the matter.
No, Honorable Khrunabhati, the principle is that no official is saying that they don't want to answer questions. But it's a point of principle that they have agreed upon that where there are issues that they feel a little bit unsure to handle that are bordering on national security, they shouldn't go and divulge it until they have consulted properly. He might have slipped his tongue in the way he responded, but I had cautioned him earlier that don't also go into an area where you create a doubt about an answer. The principle is when we are not sure and it's got border on the national security, reserve that question until you have consulted properly. In terms of the parliamentary principle, it's not that they are denying to answer the question. It's the uncertainty that goes with it in terms of your own national security. And it's correct to consult to part your political principle about what to say in the public arena. We can't stop. It's transparency, as David is saying. There's quite a lot of people who participate in the committee. That is the openness of the portfolio committee. But we don't want everything that you say that is going to compromise the security of the country to be said here. And I want to rule on this, Honorable, that David is correct. Let's stick to what David has suggested. That let's leave the minister, and he's always quite willing to go and slot it out with the minister, you see. He fights left and right, but he knows that that question can be posed easily through the parliamentary system to the minister himself. Okay.
Chair, can I finally the issue on the
minister? Let's give another member his order.
Oh, sorry.
Yes.
Chair, I asked the question. I believe that the answer, that the general should answer the question. I do not believe that it will prejudice national security, but what I'm saying is that the final decision must rest, I believe, with the delegation leader, not with the general. And I believe that the acting secretary should authorize the general now to answer the question. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We are competing with some noise again. Jefferson, I want to say that, firstly, never ask a soldier to make a decision on national security. In the Defence Force, everything is at least classified as restricted. So a soldier will always see everything as national security. That's the first thing. I mean, I will not ask a question, Jefferson, which I think will threaten the security of the state. The question I've asked, it's in the public domain. It has been in the public domain for years. It's not a new question or that suddenly it will be a threat for national security or not. I mean, I've asked this question, as I said, previously for years, many years, and it has been given. So I can't really see with great respect. And I mean, I'm the last person who will ask a question who will threaten national security. So please, if I understand it correctly, if it was not in the public domain, then accept it. But lastly, I want to say it's in the public domain. It's not something new.
No, I understand what you're saying, but you also know that terrains in terms of threats, they keep on changing, you see. So you can't determine it, everything that, in terms of security, will stay the same as they've said it last year. There are changes that will take place in anything that goes with a threat. But I'm just saying that the official might not have been in a position to give an answer that maybe that's how you want to define threat at this particular moment. And I do take what David says, that there will be some consultation between myself and the leader of delegation to say what he wants to say, but firmly, I'm saying that he is not in a position in what he's saying to give an answer at this particular moment. What do I need to say, Honorable?
Yeah, thank you, Honorable Chairperson. What Honorable Khrunabhati is saying, if something is in the public domain,
then an outside path open, he might find a way, but let us not pressure the general here. Can the leader of the delegation, the acting secretary, give us direction through you, Chairman? Thank you.
In terms of the generators that are making noise in the building, I'm told that if you switch them off, there won't be any light. It is like switching off the light. So the generators have to keep on coming on and off, Honorable. So you have to be very patient. This is the nature of this particular business. It's web. Eh? Yeah, it can affect the electricity. You might end up with no light in this particular business.
Can I just say, there's something wrong with that generator, because it sounds like a lawnmower. I can't understand if that is the case, they should have been both in a situation we don't get the noise.
Please, I just come once to this side, so I'm taking an explanation provided by Mendy Bali in a written form.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'm going to ask the committee through you to allow me to go and consult my principal on this issue. And even on that basis, Chairperson, at the moment, this is, oh, it must be right in my face.
Yes.
Oh, thank you. I was requesting, Chairperson, that we be allowed, or I be allowed to consult with my principals on this issue. And also, this is a question that I would say we had not prepared for, even if the committee can say we must respond to it now. We are still going to request that we be allowed time to go and prepare for it, because we did not have the numbers as they were asked. Thank you.
They are quite ill-prepared around this particular question. So it's a question of national security, it's a question of not being prepared. So there are two strands to the question. Let's keep it on suspense, and the leader of the delegation will have to sort it out and come back. I acknowledge what you're saying, Mr. Funabat, but as I'm saying, I'm guided also by what the department has to come. And it doesn't really mean that the minister has to come here.
Finally, Jefferson, can I just say that it is not acceptable for me that we get delegations here and we declassify or reclassify information. This information was in public domain. Now we reclassify it as it's not acceptable. I mean, you can continue, but I hope at least I can get my other answers on the questions, how many technicians, how far, many pilots are selected and everything like that. I suppose that is not national security.
I'm not disputing anything, Honorable. Mine is to mediate and make sure that you get answers. General, be assured and be making sure that you don't get into a terrain and then when you're halfway, you start thinking that this is sensitive and this is not sensitive. When questions were being asked, you're supposed to have done your homework and really give us a straightforward answer when it is compromising the country. Please don't make us deal it early around this. David, can we just go ahead?
Chair, just one final point. I mean, it seems to me that the delegation understands that we have received written responses to questions asked 2 weeks ago. We have not received those responses. And this is now, I believe, a general problem. We have to find out where they get stuck in the system. My hypothesis is they get stuck in the ministry. But I just want the delegation to understand that we have not received those answers. And so my questions about the safety and the two incidents in respect to the VIP squadron do need to be answered.
Yes, the answer that I did clarify the leader of the delegation, that those answers are not with us. Parliament don't have those answers. And then she has now recalled that those answers are with the minister, but they have not been able to come to us. We'll just have to make a follow-up to get those answers. I mean, as I'm saying, that the officials are not reluctant not to answer the questions. They are quite reluctant. They have provided the answers, but as they've also said, in the system, they have to come through the ministry. So we are waiting for the minister. Now don't start slogging out with the minister here. I'm not the minister, I'm the chair of the committee. General, do your job and do it thoroughly, man. Please.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. On the helicopter capability, issues related to the Royal Falk, I must say that the Royal Falk capability is still under a project phase. And as we speak here today, the timelines are that by next year, April, the Air Force will receive five combat helicopter capability for operational purposes. On the heavy airlift capability...
Just be clarified. Are you then saying that the Royal Falk project is on progress? They are saying the Air Force is going to use the 12 that it has ordered from Royal Falk.
The project is still on progress, Honorable Chair. And as I said, the plan, as we sit here, is that by April next year, we'll receive the first five for operational purposes. Thank you.
Chairperson, just on a point of clarity, we said something about the pilots, and now we're jumping to the Royal Fox. I've asked how many has left the Air Force and everything. Am I going to get an answer on that one or not?
I'm taking that those questions are in front of you, sir. Yeah, you are going to give us answers. They've also said that General Ludwaba here will help with the human resource part of giving answers to those questions to assist the general there. So that will be answered by you? Okay. Do you want to get the answers now? Or can you finish with the Royal Falk?
I think he's already finished with the Royal Falk. But, I just want the order. I mean, I've asked the questions on the pilots, and now we jump into other issues.
No, he said that he is answering all the other questions, confronting him, and then General Ludwaba is going to come in, and Engelbrecht is also going to come in. You will get your answer, sir. You are guaranteed 100%.
Chairperson, I'm just worried that we are not following the normal process of presentations and answers. We are continuously having an interruption or possibly a delay from the department to continue with the answers, and when those answers have been presented, if we are not satisfied, we will then have to ask further questions. But the way in which we are continuing, it looks like we are not in the normal process of presentations.
No, I couldn't apologize for that one. I think the question of the national security threat had to be clarified properly so that we could follow the process to its lack. So that was the question that really created the discussion. So I don't think members, when they want to get clarity around that, in terms of their question, they shouldn't have clarified it. But try to answer faster, General, because we've got other two presentations that we have to do.
Is it possible to follow the order in which they were asked, Because now when you jump around, I think the members get lost in the process.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I'll try to stick to the order, but how I took them, at some point I was not having a paper with me, so some of them will actually not follow a paper. But I managed to take all the questions that were asked. So I will just run through and ensure that all those questions are answered. If there is any question that I missed, because I was writing whilst listening at the same time, I will attend to that. If they can just bear with me.
We are very patient.
Thank you. Then on the heavy airlift capability, there was a question that was asked in terms of what is the Air Force doing, or are there any plans for the heavy air capability, because it was cancelled. I must say that currently we have indicated that this capability is required, but we do not have currently plans in as far as that is concerned. Joint operations in terms of supporting the external operations for heavy airlift, they are involved in the chartering of this particular capability where it is required. I would like then to answer the question related with the utilization of simulators. One honorable member asked about is it expensive and whether is it makes sense to continue using it, and whether can we feel safe if somebody is trained on a simulator or not. There is quite clearly a cheap option in using the simulator as opposed to flying the actual aircraft. It is cheaper to do so. There are certain returns that you get when you are flying a simulator, but also there are certain limitations on the simulator. As to whether you can feel safe on a person that trains on a simulator or not, people don't fly the simulator only and then go to fly. They fly the simulator and then they get on the actual aircraft to fly. Then whatever gap that is there is bridged. So that is how we are using the simulators currently. Moving on the question of the issue of the squadron. One honorable member asked about the squadron. What is exactly a squadron? How many it composed of aircraft and things like that? I will allow General Simang to elaborate on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The question here, I think he was talking on slide number 3, I think. Slide number 3. Pardon? Yes. We initially, in this opening, he indicated that we've got four squadrons, of helicopter squadrons in the country, and one fighter squadron. Basically, a squadron consists of about 120 people with the associated assets and support elements. For example, in the helicopter, would say, depending on the type of helicopters that you have, for example, with the Rayfog at 16 squadron, we've got a complement of 12 Rayfogs in that squadron. For example, at 17 squadron, we've got a complement of about 18 aircrafts in the squadron. But the personnel on the feet on the ground is about 120 people, plus minus 120 people.
Not threatening the national security by giving that
talk.
No.
Honorable
Gruber,
order. Proceed.
My apologies, sir. I say my apologies.
Please, my brother, man. Give the other one the opportunity, General.
Are you finished?
Yes, I'm through. I'm done. Okay, I'm done. Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Honorable Sir. I would like to address the question on operational budget used for upgrade. I think it was raised by one honorable member here. Why do we embark on this particular route? Because it is not the good approach. I must say that incidents have happened whereby we are forced to dig into the operational budget to resolve specific issues. Because if we do not have funding for that particular system, and the situation is getting critical, sometimes we are forced to actually utilize the operational budget to address that particular problem. And as I've indicated in the previous slide, there were issues where the upgrade was imminent and you wanted to do it, and the funds were not available and you had to use the operational budget. I must agree, it's not an optional way, but if there are situations that are beyond our control and we have to do it, that's when we take that route. But whatever we do, it's communicated and it's put on the report.
I finished, General?
Yes, I'm finished with this one.
Okay. Mamulega, can you deal with the issues of personnel?
Chair, just on the issue of, just to add on to what has been said, one must be very careful to look at just operational funds or HR, human resource funds or capital funds. The Air Force has got a specific role to play, and it's a fine balance between how you use your funds. So it serves no purpose to take all your, to leave your operational funds full knowing that you need additional funds to retain your people. So it's a continuous balancing act between putting your money, using it to the best possible benefit for the taxpayer as well. So it's not a matter of only saying, well, okay, we are not going to take our operational funds, we will dig into the HR funds, or we'll dig into the capital funds. So it's continuous, depending on the situation, to make sure that we get the optimum outputs on our budget. If the department's got a budget where it's no longer an issue, we can say, well, minimum flying hours amounts to require so many, and that budget will be distributed or split between the HR component, the operating component, as well as a capital component. So one must be, just to look at one component is may lead to wrong deductions, wrong conclusions. So it's a balancing act throughout.
Excuse me, can I say something? The other reason why we use operational funds to do upgrades is due to the fact that, as it's already been alluded, that we are grossly underfunded. All our systems have not been budgeted for the full life cycle. The full life cycle costs have not been made available. Hence, we find ourselves in this problem, whereby when you come to the midlife upgrade, whereby you need to revamp or renew, we don't have the budget, and we have to think in an innovative manner to ensure that we address issues of aviation safety and airworthiness, and that's strictly the heart of aviation. We need to ensure that those aircraft are safe to fly. Hence, we find ourselves pressurized into a situation whereby we need to use operational budget to fund capital activities, which is not an ideal situation.
No, I understand it very well, but Emil Kraft didn't give us an answer. He tell us to act on balancing, but he didn't tell us how to balance it out as the department. So your answer was not quite, it was quite evasive in general. I don't know why.
Chair, I'm sorry that it appears to be evasive. It's just the process or the approach that we follow. If, for example, you need to make sure that you have the pilots, the air traffic controllers, the technicians, you need to make sure that you've got enough fuel, enough spare parts, and the capital budget to make sure that the number of aircraft that you have can be optimally used. That's all I'm trying to say. If we do not take the operating funds to buy critical spares, for example, we will not be able to fly the aircraft. So we are not using our funds. So there's an adjustment between by way of an example, between your capital, your personnel and your operating funds. And also need to take into consideration the fact that when we compile our budget, it's 12 months before the actual expenditure takes place. It's based on a specific profile, the outputs, and as you come into the year of expenditure, things change. So you need to adapt.
Thank you. Excuse me. Can I just add on to what you just said? Due to the fact that we use the operational budget, you find that hence we've... You then find that there is a delta between the plan, our plan, and there is a delta between the plan and the and also the, our performance, because of the fact that operational allocation is used for other activities.
An honorable member, a week ago on Wednesday, I was here with my team. We presented on the exit mechanism. We presented on scarce skills. We did detail and give the tables of each and every scarce mastery within the department. And we were requested to go and categorize in terms of race and gender. The category has been done. It is among the questions that are with the minister that are still en route to the members of parliament. Unfortunately, I have a document of the details here, but I cannot make it available. But last week, Wednesday, I was here with my team to detail all the scarce masterings that are available in the DoD, including the number of pilots and the number of pilots who have left and all the other masterings that have left. I also responded on some countermeasures to try and address the reduction in the exiting of the scarce skills within the DoD. In the Air Force, we have two types of allowances that are being implemented by the DoD. We have an allowance for the technical members of the Air Force. We have allowance, we call that a TSEP. We also have an allowance for the pilots and any other air crews. We call it a MASEP. And we are currently, because the allowances that we are currently paying are not adequately addressing all the requirements of the DoD. The OSD that the public service has introduced is not also addressing our requirement. And National Treasury, the type of funding that they have been giving us, particularly to cover the OSDs, it has been the type of allowances that did not meet all those requirements. As a result, we have formed a team with National Treasury as well as the Department of Public Service and Administration to make the officials understand when we say we are unique, they must understand so that we come up with a unique OSD that is going to address all these critical masterings that we are losing in the DoD. It is unfortunate because our constitution at this time, even if we can have a retention strategy of which we do have in place, and we are monitoring on a monthly basis through our HR corporate plan, our constitution does not allow any organization to hold any member. If a member wants to leave, as an employer, you can say you can't leave. At the end of the day, that member is going to resign. And unfortunately, the salaries we pay will not be competitive to the salaries of the private sector. But the details in terms of race and gender of all the different categories of masters are detailed in a document that is en route to the members of this committee. Thank you, Chairperson.
The last part of your answer will help us when the document arrives here. I did explain all the time, you must understand other members, that there's only one person in a particular party and it's got a huge responsibility in the total run of parliament. So when they repeat their question, it's not that they are mean and they don't want to help. It is that their hands are full, you see, and it's not of their own making, it's how the political system have allowed them. So it's in their interest to get some answers. They might repeat it 4 to 5 times a year or how many times. The problem is, it's in front of him and it's something that he thinks he needs an answer so that he could continue linking it up with the other job he's doing. That's why I always ask for patience in how we keep our members informed. For them, it's much important that they get information, and how many times they repeat it, it's always going to be difficult to work out, because sometimes you give them the document, they don't find time to read. They've got other committees' work, parliamentary questions and what to be able to do in the size of his party and the contribution of his party within the parliamentary system. So I would really just appeal to be patient with these different members. It is in their interest, it's in the interest of parliament, it's in the interest of democracy for them to continuously getting information. I really understand the constraints, but it's also the constraints of our members here that they can't keep everything. You see, at least as a ruling party might have people, quite a number of them who have been involved, but in other parties, they've got their hands all over the floor. So that's why they keep on asking these questions.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just for General Mbambo to finish some of the questions that were asked, I think there was a question again on the service, keeping old aircraft and their serviceability. I think you need also to explain what you mean by serviceability. I just thought there were other members who did not understand that term properly. And also, Honourable Member Dolo wanted to know if in the incident, the Augusto that crashed, whether there was anybody who died.
If you could go a little bit faster now, so that you can ask it. We've got other two presentations to take after you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. On the serviceability, the slide that we showed there, it explains the ability of that particular system actually to do what it is meant to do. If it's a air transport system, serviceability means that transport aircraft is able to ferry members from point A to point B in a safe manner. It means it is serviceable. Why the problem of old aircraft vis-a-vis the serviceability? That's the slide that I tried to explain for the honorable members, that if the aircraft are old, it's their serviceability ratio declines simply because of the old age of the aircraft. Why we still continue to keep them? It's because currently there are no alternatives. That's why we keep them. On the issue of there was a question also on the Gripens that have been delivered thus far. The number of Gripens delivered to date is 15 that have been delivered to the South African Air Force. On the Hawk, how many that has been delivered? 26 Hawk aircraft has been delivered within the South African Air Force.
That's a lot.
Yes. Yes. And the issue of the accident or incident that happened where a pilot crashed into the water, that was the helicopter Augusta 109. There has been a board of inquiry and it was concluded, and the findings were that there was a control flight into the terrain, CFIT, meaning that particular pilot who was flying lost situational awareness and actually flew the aircraft into the water, and actually they were fatalities. And if I remember quite well, there were three. Yes, there were three. And that board of inquiry was concluded.
So he missed the ship.
If I may, it was not the one that flies with the Navy. It was the Acosta 109 that is actually flying within the Air Force.
The aircraft was en route to our training area in Drakensberg, and we're flying over a dam.
Ah, oh, okay.
Yes,
oh,
and then you... Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I'm just checking my papers to make sure that all the questions that I listed actually are ticked, because I did not list them in any particular order.
I think you're finished.
Yes, I think I've covered all.
Right. Can you go to the next one, David?
Chair, there were the two questions that of mine that were not answered. The first is, I mean, it's clear that the Gripen system is in a crisis. My question is, what is the plan in respect of the Gripen system, particularly in the light of the fact that we're pulling 971 million out of that program? I simply don't understand it. That was not answered. The second is the question of the VIP squadron. I wonder if the general could properly explain what it means to use reserve force aircraft. My hypothesis is that if an aircraft...
Don't go into your hypothesis. Let him answer the question. For time's sake, it's because you have answered the question, so if I'm going to allow you to repeat yourself, it's going to just take more time of us to go into other areas that you're supposed to be doing work on. Can you give the answer if ever...
Thank you, I'm not a chair.
Let me just check with Honorable Khurunovat. Is it on the same two questions that there? You see, I wanted us to go, we've got two presentations that we need to take now. So I wanted us to move on. So I was just giving the questions that were outstanding. That were
okay, so it's not a follow-up, it's outstanding.
Which one is that?
No, I will repeat it, Jeff.
No, that's fine. Okay. I've got no problem.
I specifically asked on slide 9. I said, it says the Hawk Squadron is fully operational for combat training, but on slide 11, it says due to inadequate funding, the Air Force has not been able to generate for the Hawk, and includes the funding of the Hawk. It's contradictory. I've asked specifically that question. I don't understand it. Can I just have clarity on that?
Can you please clarify the three questions, General Mbamba?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. On the question that was raised regarding the... Okay, let me start with the Hawk operational and versus an inability to fly the desired hours. The reason is we have received all the Hawk systems within the Air Force according to time schedule. But we are unable to fly the desired hours. And this is tied to the whole issue of underfunding. So that's basically why you are not in a position actually to fly the desired hours. On the question regarding the VIP flying and the reserve force utilization, I tried to explain that what we are doing in the Air Force is to ensure that the reserve force flying is actually utilized fully within the Air Force to meet whatever requirements for VIP flying. But I said, this goes as far as that capability is able to do so. In situations where the reserve squadrons are not in a position to meet the requirements as required by the VIP principles, then we have to look elsewhere. But clearly, as far as the VIP squadron is concerned, when we utilize them, it is a cheaper option that we can that we have within our capabilities. That is so far the issue around that.
Is it correct that, let's assume you do not have an aircraft, a military aircraft available, you're then faced with two alternatives, reserve force aircraft or civilian aircraft. But what it means in practice is that the Air Force are chartering aircraft from reserve force officers. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Can I explain? What it means is that within the Air Force, the reserve Air Force is a capability that is within the Air Force. And if we utilize them, of course there are rates that are being paid to those particular capabilities, but they are not the same as the rates that you will pay if those capabilities actually are totally outside the Air Force. So that is where the difference comes in, if that clears the question.
Can we assist you? With the Reserve Force units, the Reserve Force squadrons operate in this manner. They are tasked when we require their capacity. How do we pay them? We do not pay them in hard cash. Only thing that they do is they give us the aircraft, we fill the fuel, and then we give the reserve force pilot the allowance, and that's it. And it makes it much cheaper to operate, because they are uniformed members.
And I do think the question does warrant some more explanation. It is, it's not going wrong. It is that they are going to have to go to explain it, but won't be able to finish it now. Yeah, you will have to give us more details on how that system works. But when it gets now into private, we don't know how much we are paying. So there's a little bit of detail that we have to speak to us about. But are you finished now, General Mbambo?
No. Not
please, you are delaying us now. Can you just get finished? Yes.
Yes, Honorable Chair. The last question that was raised by Honorable Maynard, can you just repeat it again? I've just lost it. In terms of the Gripen?
I'll happily repeat it. In your presentation and in the annual report, it's clear that the Gripen system cannot be fully implemented at current funding levels. But in the adjusted appropriation budget, despite the crisis in funding, we're still pulling 971 million rand out of that project. My question is, what is the plan to fully implement the Gripen system? Either there's a plan or there is not a plan.
You've made your question. Dr. Toro, is there something that you wanted to raise?
One of my questions that didn't answer my question. My question was, there is an old aircraft. How old that aircraft? 5 years? 10 years? 20 years?
How old?
Dr. Mbambo, can you just help us with some of these things?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I will not be in a position to give the reasons as to why that amount of money is taken away from the Gripen system and elsewhere. I won't be able to answer the reasons why. I will answer, however, what we are currently doing to address the problem. Like I said, this is linked to the whole issue of relieving pressure on the Hawk system and to make sure that the Gripen at least is flown at a very minimal hours to secure, one, the integrity of the system, and to assure that the pilots that fly the Gripen, they maintain their competencies under the given situation. This is what we are doing. On the issue of the old aircraft, how old are they, and so on and so forth, I would like to draw the attention of the honorable member on that slide that I have put out there. It really indicates the different categories of aircraft and how old are they. From 0 to 14 years, we've got the Boeing 737 and the PC-12. The Boeing 737 is the presidential aircraft, which is fairly new. It falls within that category. And from 15 to 24 years, we've got the Falcon 900, which also falls within the presidential aircraft. And on the last category, the Group C, these are very old aircraft that are from 25 years and above. And the
1066
years.
Yeah, that is 1066. Don't they above? That's
yes.
66 years.
66 years. So these are the categories of the aircraft in terms of their age. And this, as I've explained, it impacts on their serviceability. Because the more the aircraft are old, it becomes very difficult to maintain them. They break quickly and so on and so forth. That's basically the situation there.
Say, regarding the 900 and odd million that's taken out of the combat budget, the allocation for the Gripen, the Hawk, the Augusta, the submarines and the frigates are earmarked funds, specifically and exclusively for that purpose. So the reason why the money was taken out at this point in time is due to a delay in the delivery of the outstanding, or not a delay, but the outstanding aircraft has not yet been delivered. So the department by itself, in terms of the appropriation bill that covers this current and any other financial year, clearly states that we cannot, as a department, reallocate that funds. That's it. So if we do not use the funds, if the milestone payments are not, if the milestones are not reached, that money goes back and it is rescheduled into the next financial year. So that is the reason why the money was taken out.
Now what we do, leader of the delegation, there are clear areas that have not been answered to the full, and some of the information is still on our way. We really want you to help us to get that information so that we should not continue repeating, answering and asking the same question. But we do need to be able to make the members happier with the questions that are outstanding. I would really appreciate that. If it's that was next day, we'll do the same answering. It's our last day today. So you just have to accept. But thanks, General, for being able to give us some information. But clarify yourself on the national threat. National security, don't say a screwdriver is a national threat and then you disappear again and you're not even sure. You must always be sure about your information. Because in the committee, the privilege of members is to ask any question. They don't know, they don't classify and reclassify information. It's your responsibility. Keep your eyes on that and always clarify yourself with what it is that they're not going to tell us. Can we have the DG from military veterans coming in? If members want to stop for a minute when he is putting his thing to there, I'll give you that opportunity. Is that okay? A minute. Not 3 minutes, 1 minute. So that he can assist us.
Presenting here to you the Department of Military Veterans progress with respect to where are we on the rolling out, establishing the Department of Military Veterans. The Department of Military Veterans is a standalone department falling under the same Ministry of Defense and Military Veterans. So it should be clear that even if we are under one ministry, we are two separate distinct departments. DOD on the other side and then DMV on the other. Chair, if I may start, so what you are saying to us is that the Secretariat, you are not working with it. And the accounting officer in the department. Is that what you are contesting?
Yes, sir. I'm not contesting. I'm just stating what is said. That the Department of Military Veterans has its own accounting officer and head of department.
To me, I'm encouraging you to do your presentation. I don't want us to start there. You see. I know I don't.
Yes, I was proceeding on that.
Yes, yes. Because now you are raising that matter for a different reason. And that information is really with you. It's not with us. Stand alone, you would have to explain yourself what you mean. Because we, in the organograms, in the explanation, in the annual report, we have not seen that stand alone. We assume that you are in one, and you are all accounting and getting your resources from the Secretary of Defense. But if there are changes, these are the changes we are waiting you to explain to us.
do you wish me to tackle that aspect
here? No, I don't know. Because you opened it up and now I was getting more interested before you do your presentation. You must understand that when you raise a question, you are raising interest to us. Because it is about the O'Connor.
Yes. If the committee recalls, if I may, when the annual report of the Department of Defense was presented, and that question did arise from the honorable members, it was indicated that that annual report, at the time that the annual report was completed, the Department of Military Veterans is not included in the annual report of the Department of Defense. And the year under consideration of the Department of Defense annual report was only up to the end of this past financial year, which is March, end of March 2010.
Equally says that when you were invited to come and sit with the Secretary of Defense, it was said that you are carrying a particular information to us. You see that annual report. It has not yet come to the attention of Parliament of how we have designed the department in a different way. So with us, our understanding is that the Secretary of Defense is the leading part in the department. If you have done changes since then, it's something that would want us to take us on board. That's what I'm trying to alert you about that. We are not aware of all the changes that you guys are making in the department in relation to the relationship between the military veterans and the capacity of the powers vested into the Secretary of Defense. Those changes, if you have made them, there is somewhere that we have not seen them in Parliament. But proceeding to me.
Chair, the scope will cover the background, the strategic plan within which there is the vision mission of the Military Veterans Department, the strategy, outputs and associated performance indicators, the output risks, and then the financial resource requirements, staffing, progress with staffing, the Department of Military Veterans, the matter of the work streams, legislation and conclusion. This presentation to yourselves builds on the presentation that was made to the Portfolio Committee in September by the Honorable Deputy Minister of Defense and Military Veterans on the reports of the Ministerial Task Team on Military Veterans, which report was tabled to this House. So, therefore, this builds on that particular presentation. But by way of background, it will be recalled that in May 2009, the President reconfigured government and introduced new ministries and new departments. And in that context, the Ministry of Defense was then reconfigured to be the Ministry of Defense and Military Veterans, to stress that particular part of and Military Veterans, which was a development that had not been there before. Pursuant to that, there was then the Proclamation 92 of 2009, which proclamation then, as signed on the 28th of December 2009, saw the proclamation of a Department of Military Veterans, but under the Ministry of Defense and Military Veterans. Subsequently, the Director General was then appointed on the 24th of February 2010 to get the Department of Military Veterans up and running. And we then set a pace to begin to start the process of structures and so on. But one of the key milestones was then to unveil the logo and the opening of the offices of the newly established Department of Military Veterans on the 30th of April in 2010. Chair, honorable members, were operating from the Denel Irene campus in El Mafias Drive, which is the same place where we had the unveiling of the logo of the new Department of Military Veterans. And you see it's that which is on the right of the coat of arms. That is the logo of the Department of Military Veterans. As additional background, I've already alluded to the fact that the cabinet, the task team report that was presented to yourselves in September, was a product that the cabinet had approved, whose recommendations cabinet had approved in June, on the 15th of June. And that cabinet approval pertained to legislation, pensions, military veterans, housing, healthcare, honor and burials, education, training and skills development, transport, compensation, business opportunities, counseling, as well as what are the institutional structures that need to be in place for dealing with matters of military veterans in totality. We have been assigned to initiate programs and ensure amendment of current legislation. In fact, it's more than amendment, it's an overhaul of the current legislation. The current legislation with respect to military veterans is the Military Veterans Affairs Act of 1999. Now, the ministerial task team report and its recommendations have been factored into and actually constitute a significant part of the amendments to them, the new legislation. The current support to military veterans, Chair and Honourable Members, is characterized by uncoordinated and uneven benefits that are rendered by different spheres of government, some of which are out of generosity. But in terms of the structure, organizational structure of the Department of Military Veterans, the Minister of Public Service and Administration approved the organizational structure of the Military Veterans Department with the post-establishment of 141 posts. And that approval by the Minister of Public Service and Administration was only effected on the 30th of June in 2010. Pursuant to that, we then set a pace to submit our first strategic plan to National Treasury, and that we did on the 29th of July in 2010. Within that, we spelled out what the vision of the Department of Defense is, and I should read it to you to reiterate, as encapsulated therein, is to ensure the vision of the Department of Military Veterans is to ensure that the unique needs of military veterans are provided for. And its mission is to initiate, manage, and administer military veterans' affairs with dignity and compassion. This will be through overall coordination and facilitation of the activities of all of government and the private sector to ensure the provision of a coherent assistance to military veterans. But furthermore, Chair, in accordance with the guidelines as issued by National Treasury, our output and associated performance indicators are as outlined there, that is five of them. The first one being well-coordinated and facilitated provision of the military veterans' healthcare and socio-economic support services. And in terms of targeted achievement of those in the reporting period at 40%. And the second output, managed and coordinated military veterans' empowerment and stakeholder relations services. In terms of that, the target we were looking at 30%. Output number three on corporate support services for the Military Veterans Department and in the Military Veterans at 70%. And output number four, executive and administrative support to the Director General at 50%. And then output number five, internal audit and risk management services at 80%. In terms of the strategy that we have built, is to establish an effective, fully functional, and a resourced Department of Military Veterans to manage and administer military veterans' affairs, and this to achieve through human capital, financial, material, and IT resources, office accommodation, legislation and policy development, conclusion of service-level agreements and memoranda of understanding, that is between the Department of Military Veterans and other departments of government, whether it's Department of Defense or Public Service and Administration, Human Settlements, and so on. and then also service delivery and client orientation. Chair, just to give you an exposition of what the financial resource requirements are for the Department of Military Veterans as allocated in the budget by the Minister of Finance during the budget at the beginning of this year, as part of Vote 21, the full cost will be illustrated, as well as the fact that, and we should emphasize that what you see there as the cost do not include service delivery for military veterans. It is mainly for the running of the operations of the Department of Military Veterans. So starting with the allocation in the 2010-2011 financial year, the allocation as provided is 20 million. The full cost is 232 million. So already, honorable members can see that what we've reflected in the rate is actually the gap between the allocated amount and the full cost for the Department of Military Veterans. That full cost includes the human resource, the capital, as well as the operation of the Department of Military Veterans. For the 2011-12 financial year, the full cost was allocated as 30 million, that is the allocated amount, and the full cost is then at 66 million. So that differential. And then 2012-13 financial year, 30 million again, and then that difference of 69 million as the full cost. So that is the way the budget looks as we speak. We should point out that there are output risks, even as we are only starting. And these output risks are as follows. Firstly, the allocations were not determined taking into account the approved structure, as well as the functional areas and delivery models based on service level agreements, that is SLA, between the Department of Military Veterans and line function departments. For instance, if we were to talk about housing for military veterans, at the point where we enter into a service level agreement with the Department of Human Settlement, that element has not been costed, or any other department for that matter, where the range of benefits that have been approved are going to be delivered for military veterans. Secondly, there will need to be a review as part of budget adjustment processes once the structure has now been final and the structure finalized and the delivery model, which has been based on firm and detailed policy proposals as already approved by Cabinet. And then, of course, lastly, on the output risk, it means that the current lack of funding implies an inability of the newly established department to achieve its mandate, mainly because the budget, as reflected there, does not even begin to talk about actual service delivery for or to military veterans. As such, our mandate, as we've already indicated earlier, currently forms part of Program 1, administration of the 2010 vote number 21, issued by the Minister of Finance at the beginning of the year. So now that the department is established, we are in the process of updating the estimates of national expenditure so that we can profile the military veterans mandate distinct with its vote, own separate vote, with effect from the 2011 financial year onwards. In terms of staffing, Chair and Honourable Members, pursuant to the Minister of Public Service and Administration approving the organizational structure of the Department of Military Veterans on the 30th of June, we went on a process to advertise a post within the structure, and on those days, on the 2nd and the 3rd of August, we advertised a total of 28 posts in those newspapers as indicated, and the closing date was the 13th of August. As of the closing date, we had received 6,189 applications for those posts, and 164 came in after the closing date. We have concluded the shortlisting process and we will be commencing with interviews from the top level and then drilling down into the rest of the structure. So in terms of work streams, as per Ministerial Task Team on Military Veterans report, it will be recalled that the task team had indicated and has now approved that in each of the areas of beneficiation, there needs to be work streams. That is basically to thresh out the details in terms of what the financial implications and the delivery models will be. For instance, if we speak of the matter of health for military veterans, there needs to be a dedicated team to look at what exactly is the scale and magnitude of the provision of health for military veterans. If we're talking about the area of housing, the same and so on, and we go. So pursuant to that, we have held engagements with the Department of Defense, especially the South African Military Health Services, with respect to the provision of health care for military veterans. We have engaged also with other departments on a range of projects, departments of communication, Department of Human Settlements, Department of Social Development, PALAMA, that is the Public Administration Leadership Academy, Academy, the old SAMDI, and the Government Employees Pension Fund, the Development Bank of South Africa, the War on Poverty Program, within what is now been put into the Rural Development Department, the Department of Transport, National Department of Transport, Department of Health, Gauteng Province. And in this engagement, we have sought to highlight to them what the status quo is with respect to military veterans, and also to seek to come to conclusion with respect to what the outcomes of a service level agreement would be in those different areas as defined in the approved areas of beneficiation for military veterans. We also, just to bring the committee and honorable members up to date with respect to legislation, on the 10th of November 2010, Cabinet approved the Military Veterans Bill. And without going into the bill itself, just to highlight that when Cabinet approved the bill on the 10th of November, it had served before the Cabinet Committee on Social Protection and then full Cabinet on the 10th of November. And then the focus area of the bill is on those areas addressing the plight of military veterans, what is the legislative protection for military veterans, what are the determined entitlements and benefits for military veterans, specifically in those areas of housing, health care, educational opportunities, business opportunities, pension, and transport with respect to public transport. And then recognition of a National Military Veterans Association. That is also included there. Chair, also we've just included the substituted the long title of the bill, and then also revised the definition of the military veterans, and then added various benefits and the administration for those benefits, eligibility in terms of who is eligible. Even as you say, military veterans are eligible to those benefits.
Sorry, DJ.
Yes, sir.
Where is the copy of this one?
It's in the slide.
Yeah. We've got this one copy. Yeah. I accept it on the slide.
Okay.
I'm saying copy for the members of parliament. Can't you just get them to do a copy?
Okay.
Can you just give a copy?
Yeah. Okay. Okay, Chair.
Mendy? The honourable member don't have this one. She didn't give it to you. Oh, you've got this one. Yeah. Most of what is spoken before,
yeah,
it's in here. It's a bill that we don't have in front of us. Yes. Is that correct, Babu Michael?
Yes, correct.
Okay. That's all, are you fine? Okay, that's good.
Okay, as they make copies, should I proceed?
No, no problem.
Oh, okay. The eligibility, and then establishment of an appeals board, and then functions of the department, benefits and entitlements, substituted for development programs, and then matters incidental thereto. The objects of the bill are to provide for, and Chair, let me just say that we are just capizul with respect to the bill. We are just picking on the highlights because the bill has not been formally tabled before Parliament. But the last part on the object of the bill is to provide for the benefits and entitlements to military veterans and their dependents, to determine eligibility of military dependents, and then also to provide for the president to be the patron-in-chief of all military veterans. This is a provision that was there in the old Act, in the 1999 Military Veterans Affairs Act. And then the establishment of an advisory council and an appeal board, and then for certain functions of the department and development and implementation of policy and matters incidental thereto. So, Chair, that in a nutshell, the last three, just the highlights of what is in the bill, which is coming to you. To add that the bill is currently in the process of being gazetted. It should appear on Friday, this coming Friday, 2 days from now, in the Government Gazette. Secondly, it is in the process of being certified by the State Law Advisor, and we have been informed that that will also be concluded by Friday. And once the certification and the gazetting have happened, then it will be formally tabled before yourselves. Chair, that concludes the brief presentation we had with respect to progress since the establishment of the Department of Military Veterans. I thank you.
Okay. It does come as Instruction 75/76. The bill? 75/76.
Can the Honourable Member explain what 75?
So in terms of the constitution,
two houses.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. That's what I'm trying to establish, that it is supposed to go. You see, with the defense, as you have seen in the last bit, it's a 75, and then sometimes it comes in a 76. That's what I wanted to establish. In what context have we established the bill itself? Has it to go to both houses, or has it to go to one house?
Yes, to both houses, Chair.
Okay.
Mainly because the delivery for military veterans is something that has to be done by also the provincial government. But that said, the Department of Military Veterans is a national department. So it operates within the national sphere of government. Even if in the structure or the establishment of the Military Veterans Department we have provincial coordinators, they do not have any of those competencies. It remains a national department.
No, we'll recognize what you are saying, but you know, we are the legislators at the end of the day. We write the law. So be open minded that we might bring in some amendments at some stage. Yeah. Honourable members, that was what the department wanted to do, to update you of the work that they've been able to do and some expectations for the coming year. We thought that in discussion with the DG that before you go for recess, be informed about what is going to be expected, because they're going to meet many of these people, and military veterans keep on asking what are we doing in terms of their plight. So I thought you need to get something more tangible in writing, what that creation is meaning and what is going to happen in the near future, so that you don't talk and see things happening in papers. I'll start with Honorable Mpahlele, and I'll come back to you, David, and I'll come back to Honorable Masango, I'll come back to Honorable Mazia, and I'll come back to Dr. Dor.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. And thank you, DG, for the presentation. I think we're getting somewhere. It's just that the slides are not numbered, so I'll just say page 2, the slide below, the bottom one. There's somewhere where you talk about honor and burial. Well, I think it should be honor, burials, perhaps, and reburials. Because, well, it can be burial and reburial. Yeah. Because I think quite a lot of veterans, some were hung, executed, and their bodies are still lying there at Pretoria Central. They have to be reburied, others even buried in exile. And business opportunities, blah, 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 transport. I strongly feel that veterans deserve land, because if they're given land, they're empowered forever. But with those food handouts that the deputy minister recently handed out in Durban, I think they ate them up that day, and they're hungry today. But if they were given land, they would farm it, they would raise chicken on that land and do meaningful things on it. And it won't be for the first time in this country that veterans from the war are rewarded with land. So my problem is, why people don't get land now, whereas they've been getting land in the wake of wars, previous wars. So I think land should be, actually should be number one, because we are fighting for land, at least PAC was. Then, on the question of military veterans, well, maybe we'll have to define who is a military veteran. Because Honorable Chair, recently I read in the paper that an old man who participated in the Second World War, incidentally his father participated in the First World War and died during the sinking of Mendi, that guy is not getting any benefit from the department. He lives in Duncan Village in the Eastern Cape. So I think our definition of military veterans should not be confined to recent conflicts or wars. Even those who fought in the Second World War, like the old men in the Duncan Village, should be covered. Fortunately, there are not many of them. Then, on the staffing, you said advertisements were out on City Press, Western, Sunday World, etc. Was there any criteria for the applicants, qualifications, minimum qualifications for those applicants? Now, lastly, the recognition of Military Veterans Association legislatively is something that we are still waiting in the hard copy. Well, it dovetails with page 3, the top slide, whereby you say the current support to military veterans is characterized by uncoordinated and uneven benefits rendered by different spheres of government out of generosity. Well, uncoordinated and uneven. But I think, DG, you should have said partisan and factional. Uncoordinated, uneven, partisan and fictional benefits, because that is exactly what is happening. And you know, for a fact, DG, that APLA Military Veteran Association is not recognized by your department. And my question is, if the Military Veterans Associations are going to be recognized legislatively, which means APLA is going to miss the boat, because the Military Veterans Association, of which I'm a member of APLA, is snubbed by your department. And actually, you attended a meeting in Mthatha where your department called on the police to take out APLA Military Veterans Association. Now, when this thing is elevated to a legislation, that in a nutshell, it means legislatively, APLA is going to be elbowed out of the system. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Three quick questions. Cabinet has evidently now approved a bill, and that bill, once we've moved to the processes, will be tabled in Parliament. But what I would like to know is whether the department have run any models to calculate and model the cost implications of this bill. I would be surprised if the cabinet approved a bill without a detailed analysis of the cost implications of the bill. That's the first question. The second question is the Ministerial Task Team report. Now, the Deputy Minister undertook to furnish this committee with a report. The Director General says that the report has been tabled in Parliament. I do not have a copy of that report, and I would not want us to get into a situation where we are deliberating on a veterans bill without the task team report. We don't want to get into a repeat performance of the interim report saga. And then finally, on page 2 of your slide, one of the benefits which military veterans will be entitled to is evidently business opportunities. I wonder if you could specify exactly what that means and what mechanisms you intend to put in place to give military veterans business opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. So let me just start by saying we understand and we acknowledge that there is a plight in the military veterans, that they need to be helped. But I'm just really concerned that we are starting this department clearly from the start with less funding. So we'll be complaining about less funding until I don't know how many years, because from the onset we already don't have money. And if you look at that money, it's already only going to cater for administration. And I'm just asking myself, in which way are we going to assist those veterans if all the money is actually catered for administration only and nothing else? So we are just creating another problem before even we start with the department. But I just want to ask the guy, I also agree with Mr. Mpahlele that we really need to have a definition of military veterans so that we all were on par on what is a military veteran. It is very important. But I just want to, on page 2 also, I just want to understand what we mean by conversation so that we all understand what is that conversation going to be. So that we are not confused. We pay people for something that we don't understand what is it. But Chairperson, looking at the strategic plan, especially the targets, you know, sometimes I get confused with the targets that talks about percentage. Like the output number 1, 40%. I'm not going to be sure what is 40%. I'm not going to be sure what is 10% until they can tell me numbers so that they have a target of numbers to say, this is what we are going to do to assist so many people or whatever the case may be. Then we can conclude and say, yes, we have reached 40%. But just to say 40% out of this and the 60%, is going to be difficult. I don't know how are you going to calculate and tell us that we have achieved 40 or 60% or 30%, because there is nothing that we can say it is zero. So we need to go and unpack this one so that we can all understand what will we be achieving, so that we all are on par. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. In follow-up to Honorable Mpahlele's input on the third page, this second paragraph, I don't know, Chairperson, but I hope that since the department is now established and it's in operation, this paragraph is going to disappear. I hope so. In the response, I want the department to tell us that this part is being coordinated now and is under their control, so that we know there will be progress. On page 2, on the second slide, the background, I am also worried, Chairperson, to have an impression presented that if I resign tomorrow from Parliament as a military veteran, I will have the privilege to business. I am concerned also, Chairperson. Now, I want to raise three questions on education, training, and skills development. The question that I want to raise is the question around once people have been trained, because we are speaking about veterans here, once they've been trained and they've got capabilities, do we have a program as of what are we going to do with them? Is there a placement program for these people once they've been trained? Or are they just going to be trained and developed and left to pick up their papers? Because some people, when they've got a lot of education that they cannot use, they go and pick up papers, and that's the best thing that they can do. On the part of compensations, Chairperson, as I speak now, you know, when you have to go and do a claim as published, the number of offices that you visit before you even get the claim, and then the number of requirements that are expected by the department are denying some members the privilege to even go and claim. Because if you have to visit 4 or 5 offices before your application is processed, and you are moving from no any financial support. Let's assume that I'm not employed now and I have to go and make an application for a compensation, and I have to visit 5 offices which are not placed at the same building. You move to this building, you must take a taxi to another building, you take a taxi to another building. Before you fill up all the necessary requirements, you have visited more than 5 towns. Is that not an excuse to deny some members the right to their claims? On the part of counseling, Chairperson, I would be happy that in some time to come, if the department can give us a report of what has been achieved in the processes of counseling. And why I'm interested in this part I'm interested because I know, Chairperson, and this is an issue that some of us who have appeared before the TRC have recommended, that the need for counseling is necessary. And although we have not seen it happening except in small scales, we are very much interested, some of us, to know the output of these counselings, if we can know, and then if we can even go to the extent where this part is being used above veterans. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Comrade Chairperson. I've got a two question, Comrade Chairperson. On page 6, 6,181 application were received for the total of 28 posts advertised and 164 came in after the closing date. I just find out, Comrade Chairperson, what kind of information or method to make sure South Africans know, all of us. Why am I asking this question? I'm in the rural area where I came from. And if you can say newspaper, TV, and radio, you'll find a rural area, some places, even the radio that's not working. Now, if maybe the 28 come after when it was closing date, that I just find out what kind of method do you use for the rural people to know. And another question, Jefferson. You know, there is a freedom fighters. Some of them, they are dying. But if you can look at their wives, they are suffering like a suffering. Now, I'm not sure those kind of people, if their husband, they die, and they were freedom fighters, what the department do to help those, their wives? For example, where I came from, you know, I'm a rural man, and I know in the rural area there's a problem. Sometimes, some people are talking about rural area, they hear somebody talking about rural area, I'm saying that. Then Africanist Congress, you know, I'm so painful when Comrade Pashela talking about the freedom fighters of PAC. We must be careful. If we ignore some others, I'm telling you, one day it's going to be a big issue. Paul Masha is a PAC member. He's my next door. Old man, it was fighting left and right and all those things. They die. If you can see his wife and children, shocked. I think that I'm not sure those kind of people, my leader, how can, I mean, what can we do to help them? Because if we ignore some other freedom fighters, must be careful. The Bible says the stick of matches is too small, but one day it's the whole country. If we let some others, and that I think they will create problems the times come. I think, what about those kind of those people? Thanks very much.
For your answer questions, we are supposed to have taken the health services. And I must say that it seems as if we are a tough past 12 now. And I just consulted with the leader of your delegation. It seems we'll have difficulty to have you on. And I don't want to take you in a half-hearted way where your presentation is very crucial, because you also want to know exactly what is going on. So would you mind if we schedule it for next year when we come back?
That's fine.
Is that okay? You won't have a problem at all.
Yes.
You could see the excitement of members now about the military veterans. So it is going to take us some time to get answers and get some more clarity. The one part is because it's our last day today to take presentations. Tomorrow, we're doing farewell speeches and we're going to recess. So this one is one of the soft spots that I thought that members of parliament must be prepared for to go and answer as they go into their constituencies. I really want to apologize on behalf of the committee that we put you in this predicament. We wanted to have you so that you could all satisfy ourselves about the challenges and work that you have. We will discuss as a committee how do we prepare for you so that we prioritize and take you through. I really apologize on behalf of parliament that I brought you down here and I couldn't take you through the process. I really, really want to deal. But it's also, if you feel that you want to listen to military veterans, you can listen. If you feel that now that I can release you, and then we'll meet with you in the coming.
You will listen.
Yeah. No, you see, the DG pushes his luck, you see. Yeah. So. Okay. No, that's fine. I was the leader of the delegation was whispering. Can I give members of parliament to take two? I see Honorable Mpahlele, you've got the question. Yeah. And then I'll take Mlambo. Tatum Mwangu, do you want to do something?
I would have, but I'm actually constrained by the fact that when the presentation was made, I was out. But I do have a question.
No, you look, you've got the privilege of talking. I'll tell you if you've spoken out of sync. I can't suppress you because you did alert me that you've got an urgent thing that you have to go and attend. I'll give you after Honorable Mlambo. Let me just give Ubabu Mpahlele.
Thanks so much, Honorable Chair, for the privilege. Yeah, on the question of counseling that Honorable Mazia made mention of, DG, don't you think it worthwhile that the experience, the history of the former political commissars, especially as far as Liberation Armies are concerned, should be utilized, because my personal experience is that a person would get frustrated, take drugs, abuse alcohol, go to institutional recognized counseling outlets, and you find that no change, is recorded. But once his former commander, commissar, a person that they were with in Morogoro, Tanzania, or Angola, you find that, without charging any fee, but the person drastically changes. So I think that should be considered, the utilization of the colleagues, of especially political commissars. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine to the DG is that I'd like to thank him first for this good presentation. The issue here about the database, because it's a crucial one, I don't know if they have established already. Well, it's a new department, I understand, or they have a plan. How are we going to collect the database about these military veterans? That's one. The second one, is there a plan? Because as Utati Dole has just mentioned, that there was an old man who was staying next to his place and he passed on. Fortunately for him, he was having a family. But there are those who don't have families, who are living alone, who need some kind of care. If they have a plan in terms of an old age home, where only for military veterans, where they will be collected through the database that they will have collected. And the kind of classification, because these things, they go with years. from World War One, Two, and the liberation struggle. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Guys, really, mine
was actually on the issue of the definition. I mean, who is a military veteran? How far back do we go? I hear my comrade here talking about First World War, 1918, and so on. And those people who actually participated in those wars are now becoming an endangered species because there are very few of them left now. And secondly, the issue of the criteria. I mean, how do we decide that this one is a military veteran? My other colleague has actually spoken about the issue of the database, because that is very important as far as I am concerned, and that such a database be actually made public, so that people, everybody knows who the military veteran is, and the whole issue of reskilling, the skilling process, because not all of them are old people. There are people who actually have been involved in one way or the other, who actually are still active. People who can actually contribute to the economy of the country one way or the other if they were properly skilled. Is there any attempt that is being made to actually identify those and actually also identify the kind of skills through which they can be taken for training purposes, other than actually thinking about, you know, getting them into the police or just retiring them, when in fact they can actually still contribute in the building of the country in one way or the other.
Yeah, thank you very much to you, Comrade Jefferson. Sometimes when you started to be old man like a Madame Lange, some others you just forgotten, you know. You know, Jefferson, I just find out we are talking about our military veterans. You know, always I'm asking this question in number, how many of them? Because now we are talking about financial resources requirements. How many of them? Because there is a corruption in South Africa, but we are lucky in our Department of Defense. It's, you know, I think discipline is there. We are proud about that. I'm not saying there's no something wrong somewhere there, but truly speaking, it's not easy. In the radio, they are talking about defense, corruption, and so on and so on. Not that there's no problem, sometimes there and there. But my question is that we are talking about financial resources requirements on page 5. But how many in number? If I'm not mistaken, Chairperson, the army member, 75,000, if I'm not mistaken. But you know more than myself. But now, the military veterans, talk about the budget or whatever, the money, how many in number now? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Yeah, it clearly shows that the bill that they're bringing into Parliament is going to carry a lot of debate and discussions. It would be nice to have the process early worked out properly so that I can give members an opportunity to even consult their constituencies in the coming year, so that there can be a better contribution. It would be in the interest of Parliament and society to do it in a far different way. It is going to have a lot of discussion. But the one thing that in your last slide, all this talking to Department, Communication, Human Settlement, and all the different institutions, are they going to put in money? That's what we must be frank about. Are you looking for money, or are you looking for what type of MOUs? Then Mr. Mazia's question will continue to bring more problems. Like, are you going to say to what? How is the department going to structure itself? Are you going to come to military veterans registers and then they say, you want a house, go to human settlement, and you go into another queue? What is the real arrangement that we're beginning to talk about?
health, how is that going to be structured? I mean, I'm just saying that what are the practicalities that is going to confront military veterans in terms of your consultations, and also in terms of beyond the bill, practicalities, relations with the different departments. Do you want us to develop an instructive, I mean, legislation that instruct them to help these military veterans, or what are you saying? I must clarify that the report that you are calling that comes from Cabinet, that the Ministerial Task Team report has not yet been placed in front of Parliament, essentially. You see, the procedure here is that whatever comes to Parliament has to come through the Speaker, and the Speaker then gives it and then like distributes it amongst members. That process has not occurred. So it will always be difficult. You see, we have not been able to address the NCACC because the NCACC repeats this problem all the time. When they submit a report, they send it to the committee. The committee can't do anything. It's hands tied. The Speaker is very sensitive and careful these days. You do something without his knowledge, he sanctions you as a committee. So that report, in that terms of process, hasn't come to that particular process. And that why, Honorable David, it is not in front of you at this particular moment. So, the Ministerial Task Team report. I need to give him to give some answers. I don't want to, but Honorable Mazia had asked him an opportunity before the DG answered.
I've just left out one particular thing. There is in some of the problems that I've raised, Chairperson, it's your compensation offices. It seems we don't have these compensation offices in all the provinces and all the regions. They're all centered around Tshwane. That should be looked into. In the posts that were advertised, we know that some of the veterans have got very high qualifications. Were they encouraged to apply, or is the department going to make some kind of some sort of placements? I know that democratic processes should take place in terms of interviews and so forth and so forth. But if we have got veterans who qualify, who are meeting the criteria, is it going to be a problem if they are given first preference?
Very historical that you are covering. I need to fall off the chair. I knew, I know you. DG, I know you won't be able to cover all the questions and answers. There's a thing and lunch that takes place at 1 o'clock, and members, in terms of their own capacity, who are starting the house at 2 o'clock. So it would be preferable that some of the other questions that are very extensive and that need a lot of answering, you either take them down and put them down in writing and send them back to Parliament. Even during this holiday, we'll see how we distribute it amongst members. But at 1, I would want to really leave the members so that we can go for lunch, so that I can have them back next time when I need them in the committee. Do your best and see how far you can answer.
Thanks, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. With respect to the question raised by Honorable Member Mashele on the matter of expanding on that provision in the benefits of honor burial to include reburial, that matter can be considered by the department as part of broader government policy with respect to reburial. This question did arise even at the time that the task team report was presented to the portfolio committee in terms of what the policy is on reburial, especially in cases where people
have to be reburied when they would have died outside of the country. The question of land, so we are not averse to looking at land as a specific benefit. It will form part of the approaches to different entities of government with respect to what is it that specific departments or entities of government can do with respect to veterans. We are aware, for instance, that some provincial governments have given land in certain instances to military veterans. But as a Department of Military Veterans, we have not done that. And that will form part of the engagements with not only that specific department, but also the rest of the other departments in terms of, insofar as their line function is concerned, what is it that they can do for military veterans. But there definitely has been some approaches and some of the military veterans been given land in whatever form they've organized themselves. On the definition of the military veteran, we had made that definition in the task team report as adopted by the task team. And just to put members at ease, I'll just reiterate that particular definition as presented to yourselves and subsequently approved by Cabinet. The definition of a military veteran is any South African citizen who has retired from active service rendered to any of the military organizations, whether statutory and non-statutory, which were involved on all sides of South Africa's liberation war from 1960-61. Secondly, all those who served in South Africa's Defence Force before 1961, and also those who became members of the new SANDF after 1994, who want to contribute to the establishment of a moot principle, just and free South Africa, based on the principles of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Yeah, that is the definition. So it will cover World War I, World War II, the Korean War, war veterans, and the period beyond that up to present. Remembering that the operative word is who has retired from active service rendered in those different categories that have been mentioned. With respect to the staffing criteria and whether the minimum qualifications will be considered, Chair, Honourable Members, in the advertisements that were placed, the general standard that is applicable across the public service was applied in terms of the requirements for a post requirements to fill a particular post within a department. So that was specified. Minimum qualifications and or also experience was also placed within that. I should say that there will be further rollout of advertisements of posts for the department, because that 28 is only the first part if one looks at the totality, that is 141 of the posts on the currently approved structure of the Department of Military Veterans. On the recognition of military veterans organizations, Chair, we do recognize military veterans associations in accordance with what the Act, because currently we are operating on the Military Veterans Affairs Act of 1999. However, the legislation that will be coming to you will be looking at reviewing the bulk of the provisions of that Act. And some have been taken in, since others, in terms of what the task team has recommended, has been put into the draft of the legislation. But that recognition is there by the Department of Military Veterans. On the question that Honourable Member Manir has asked, or before I get to that, the last question the Honourable Member Patel has raised on uncoordinated, uneven. benefits rendered by different spheres of government with respect to military veterans. Oh. Yes, sir.
Now, I just wanted to check with you on these things of the military, the Samba bodies that are getting formed now. You mean that the legislation will have an influence on these provincial conferences that have been run now when you pass that legislation?
Okay, let me answer that immediately. Chair, the existing legislation calls for an existence of a body or a federation of all military veterans associations. Subsequent to that, SAMBA was then established in 2008, September, and what the legislation that will come before you will then have is to recognize that structure, the federation of all the military veterans association coming in. It does not specify individual military veterans association, but that particular body. So it is that which is being proposed as a recognition of that structure, which is outside of the Department of Military Veterans, but as its own entity, supported, of course, by the Department of Military Veterans.
So, let's not open it. I was trying to get more clarity. In your capacity as a member of parliament, you have to look at that legislation and re-look at it. I was just trying to get more information at this particular moment. But it's quite clear that that one is going to also open up some discussion and debate in how we handle it. Go ahead, that. Okay. But at 1 o'clock, you must concede that I'll have to give members, and members will have to accept that. I don't want to take your lunch time away.
Okay. Chair, I'll try and speed up in the little time left. On the question asked by Honourable Member Manir on whether the Cabinet approval of the bill, that costing was done, Chair, the costing has not yet been done. What has been approved are the main principles. There is a process underway. We are engaging National Treasury to actually bring their skill with respect to costing and budgeting of each of the benefits that have been spelled out. For instance, if you are talking delivery of health care for military veterans, how much is that going to cost? In fact, on that specific one, we've already done significant progress and should be finalized with it before the year is out. And then on the others, we are engaging also with those line function departments as well as provincial government administrations that will be delivering on the specific mandate. So if we're talking housing, similarly, to then engage with the National Department of Housing, Human Settlements now, and as well as the provincial elements there to say these are the number of military veterans. Of the totality of the number of military veterans, only X number will be in need of that. And then there's the process that is followed. For instance, the Eastern Cape provincial government at the beginning of October provided 44 houses to military veterans in the area of PE. And we are aware we continue to engage with other outing and so on. With respect to the matter of business opportunities and what model that would follow, this is more in terms of assisting the military veterans and coordinating that effort, not necessarily that business opportunities would be given by the Department of Military Veterans, but to assist with existing entities in government as well as in the private sector. So, for instance, if you are saying the DTI or other small business development or SMME entities across government, to engage with them to then say, what business opportunities may be there in specific sectors that can then enable that the military veterans are then employed or they start up their own businesses in that engagement. So that is something that that is intended there. The Honourable Member Masang's question on the funding unavailability and until when will we be saying that lack of funds? Chair, Honourable Members, That question we cannot answer now, but we need to bring to light to the committee that even what you see and what has been apportioned by the Minister of Finance does not even begin to speak, even to the structure, just the structure itself of the Department of Military Veterans, let alone the delivery of the benefits. In terms of the targets that have been listed in the output, those are modest targets that have been placed for, at the time that we're doing this, for the time between July and the end of the financial year, in terms of the extent to which we would be able to meet those targets. Of course, we will need to go back and revise them, because achievement of those targets is contingent upon a number of factors. First, that there is the required human capital, human resource, to be able to drive some of those programs that have been listed there, and then also the availability of funding for that. So we have set ourselves a modest target between now at that time and the end of the financial year, and we'll continue to revise that as we continue to staff the department.
DJ, not have to really suspend business now, I suppose. It's going to go into the lunchtime, and I must remember the house is starting at 2 o'clock today. Don't really have to disrupt you and allow you to do in writing some of the responses that we have. But we'll definitely be meeting next year, and we'll give you more time, both you and Seth and the military, for us to be able to do. But at least members have a sense now of where the military veterans department is going. I must again apologize. You don't mind, DJ, that's what I really want to persuade you. I mean, you at least have given us a sense of what is going to be expected of the bill. And now at least now honorable members would have to prepare themselves for that small, it's going to be a little bit of a battle, but it's a battle we have to go through. And I still want to apologize to the military health division that we are very sorry about what we have done, and would really prepare for you so that we could hear and listen to you. And I still want to thank again the Secretariat for being able to have given us this opportunity of engaging again after the annual report. Don't stop our approach, and we hope that we learn more from each other. From me, honorable members, this is the last day of your committee. We do hope that we'll see each other next year. We're not going to call unless there was an emergency. It's clear that the bill is not available, so we won't be able to go into the bill itself. So you do hope that you enjoy your Christmas and New Year's, and you come back in full so that you can all start with some good energy that is left within us to do the responsibility. Bye-bye to everybody. See you next year. Thank you.
How are you? Actually, I must speak because they ran out of time, so there's one thing on here that they didn't cover at all, and that I turned it in. Yes, they must be because by next year they would have changed.
And also the yesterday's one.
Got it. Popped it for that.
And yeah, recording that.
That's what
you
want.
So that audio recording.
You can read the recording on the website. You can
just cut out.
I listened to the beginning and the end. I thought you missed it at the beginning because it started with the Secretary of Defense presentation, and she was thanking the minister. So we missed other after the minister is probably just introducing
off.
And I think we got to read.
All right.
Yes, this is what they found out as well, because all time they
missed
was this afternoon.
Yeah.
You know, what happened to me this morning is you get stuck in the traffic and you have to continue.
Yeah.
I'm going to
$1,000 to pay for the game, but at least I've got all the electronics.
Oh,
thank you so much.
Thank you.